morning, or just about afternoon now, and welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday special. This is our weekly rundown of the week that was, some of the stories that we all know about, some of the stories that maybe we heard a little bit about and passed under the radar. I am delighted to be joined by trade union activist, organizer, and actually human rights activist as well, Julia Marciniak. Julia, how are you keeping?
Yeah, very good. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be in here today.
No, thank you for coming. It's been a while since we've spoken, especially on the pod, but I'm glad to see you. And we're rejoined by, at this stage, you're a regular Emma, Emma D'Souza. She's another human rights activist, campaigner, and a very big advocate for the Good Friday Agreement. And it's fairly pertinent that you join us this morning, Emma. First of all, how are you keeping?
Very well, thank you. Great to be back.
Yeah, look, I am going to go straight to you if that's okay. We've had some really, people just have to look at your timeline, because you've quoted some of the stuff and you've discussed some of the things that have been said by Mr. Poot since he has taken over the rule is the word that slipped out. Isn't that funny how it betrayed what it sounds like? Because it does very much sound like a man who is trying to rule over his party and rule over a section of loyalism and unionism, and it was very uncomfortable. Emma, do you want to just give us a flavor of some of the things that you've seen and why we should all be paying more attention to it?
Well, I mean, it's quite a lot to unpack just in this week alone. Of course, there were absolute scenes at the DUP ratification process, with a number of the party's top brass walking out before Edwin Poots even gave his opening speech. So it does show us that there is some pretty substantial divides in the party itself. But when you look at the words used by Edwin Poots during his first speech as leader of the DUP, you know, it was the language of war. You know, he used terms such as enemies and the fighting and the battle ahead. And, you know, you have to look at that language and wonder what audience is it that he's playing to with those words. It's not reflective of Northern Irish society today. And, you know, this is not 1921. It's not 1985. It's 2021. An entire generation have grown up under the cover of the Good Friday Agreement, and substantial gains in reconciliation have been achieved in that time. So the language being used is quite concerning for any of us that advocate for the Good Friday Agreement or who are trying to push forward to create a rights-based society in Northern Ireland. There's also concern to be had around the claims by Sir Geoffrey Donaldson that his camp received threats from the UDA whenever he was running for the leadership position himself. And there was also claims that other DUP representatives received threats from the UDA in terms of signing the letter of no confidence against Arlene Foster. So questions there are, you know, the normalization of paramilitary organizations in democratic processes and politics in Northern Ireland. And then also, why did the UDA want Edwin Poots to be the leader?
Taking that into that for a moment, the language was very definitely the language of war. The language was very definitely the language of, you know, the rhetoric of us versus them. There was no attempt to really call for any sort of compromise. It was hardline language is what it was in effect. You've raised the question, who is he trying to appeal to? And then when you mentioned then a paragraph later the UDA, well, the answer's kind of in the question in many ways, and that is very concerning. I mean, we spoke to Colin Harvey from Queens, and he was brilliant talking about, and he kind of brushed over the fact that he'd received threats. He'd received all sorts of awful things directed at him, and yet he's kind of trying to focus on a shared island, a new constitution for what it might look like and how things might work, whether it's going to be, you know, federalism or whatever the model is. And he was real positive. But when you hear that kind of that kind of rhetoric, is it concerning for someone like you who's been banging on for a good while now about the need to actually, you know, not just have the Good Friday Agreement as a document, but have it as a living document?
It is concerning. And I think that, you know, the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement was recently there on the 22nd of May in terms of when the vote actually took place 23 years ago. And I often find myself feeling very reflective around this time of year over what progress has been made, what progress hasn't been made. And when we look at what was envisioned in 1998, we are, you know, at times quite far away from making real the promises and commitments that were made to people and the democratic mandate that was handed down by the people of this island in 1998 has really been held back, not by people, but by the political institutions that are not making the progress that's required and needed in terms of making the next steps of reconciliation. And I wonder if perhaps at times the reason why we haven't made successive gains in the Good Friday Agreement is because a party that never signed up to it in the first place has so much power still within their political institutions. And we've seen recently that the DUP, I think it was Jim Wells in particular, said that, you know, of course they wanted and hoped for a border on the island of Ireland, and that's why they backed Brexit. So I think that we're seeing time and again that the party is not supporting the aspirations within the Good Friday Agreement, but rather trying to align themselves with the cohort of people who didn't support the agreement, because there's always been groups opposed to the Good Friday Agreement, but they are increasingly a very small minority.
Just going to pause the podcast there for a minute to ask for your help. As many of you know, for 20 years I've been trying to get somewhere in tackling bogus self-employment. The Tortoiseshack has helped me with the agency and clout to go at the government with it, with this. And lots of you have supported me and made it possible for the government to ignore what's going on. I'd like to thank you all for that. But here's the problem. While the work has value, it doesn't happen without money to keep it on track. So do me a favor and head to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and sign up. It's £6 a month, and there's loads of extras for that as well. But even if there wasn't, I'd like to think that after 550 episodes, the Echo Chamber has proven to be worth your support. So have a gander at patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and I'll let you get back to your pod now. Thanks.
Sorry, Martin. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a good point. They are a small minority, but there's a huge amount of pandering going on to this small minority, both north and south. And that you have to ask the question, does it come to the stage where people say, well, you are a very small but vocal minority, you don't reflect the views of the majority, and is there a split coming in the DUP or even an exodus from the DUP to something a little less prehistoric?
Well, let me see. If I take the pandering to the very vocal minority first and then move on to the split of the DUP, I think that, you know, yes, it is pretty incredible to see, for example, how much reporting is done around the LCC, the Loyalist Communities Council group, who represent a number of illegal Loyalist paramilitary organizations. And yet you would think they were some sort of legitimate political entity by the amount of reporting and also political engagement that's happening with that organization at the moment. And we do see a very deliberate attempt at creating this narrative of the people of Northern Ireland being in mass opposition to the Northern Ireland Protocol, which couldn't be further from the truth, because pro-protocol parties still have majority support in Northern Ireland. And the people of Northern Ireland didn't vote for any kind of Brexit, never mind the hardline Brexit that has been brought in by Johnson's government. So there is this deliberate attempt to try and make it seem much bigger than it actually is. And we saw this morning on the Mar show, Edwin Putz depicting a Northern Ireland that has violence on the streets and that the people have lost faith in the Northern Ireland Protocol. But Edwin Putz can't speak for the people of Northern Ireland. Rather, the DUP can only speak for, at most, their voters, which are about 220,000 out of an electorate of 1.33 million. And then in terms of looking at the split of the DUP, very difficult time for those within the party who are going to struggle, I think, now to find a political home, because we've seen the ratification of Doug Beattie in terms of leadership of the DUP, which went through with no problems, unlike the ratification of Edwin Putz. But he will be trying to take the UUP into a more progressive, liberal side of unionism, which many of the DUP representatives who may be considering leaving their own party might struggle to find a political home in a more progressive Ulster Unionist Party, and equally might find it difficult to find a political home in Alliance. So I think that there's a real risk in terms of a section of unionism now not having a place to call home. And when we see the election coming around next year, it's more likely, in my view, that we're going to see a substantial portion of unionism just staying home.
It's again in the numbers game, going to the actual demographics. We don't, you know, you won't have an island of 6 million people that will have to be led by 220,000. But it also reminds me of, you know, when we ran it with, in the run up to a referendum, we obviously had a very traumatic and at times confrontational repeal referendum that everybody was celebrating the anniversary of, 3-year anniversary of this week. And we talked about how at the same time a minority were always given equal footing. You know, we had this balance, and this is how it's gone. Just in terms of the alliance, just for listeners, we will be talking to Kate Nicol. Yeah, she's the incoming mayor of Belfast, and she's the Alliance Party. So we'll be talking to her this week as well. So it'll be interesting to get Kate's perspective on that. And we're hoping to go to the UUP, which will be fun. I'm anticipating. I loved Emma that you said that the more progressive elements of the UUP, because we had this conversation where someone said to me recently that, oh, sure, he's a socialist. He believes in a woman's right to choice within the UUP. And we went, that's not what we mean by socialism, mate. But nonetheless, it was nice to have. It was nice to see a progressive leaning thing. Wait, look, we're going to move on a little bit, and because I want to move on, because ultimately, Don, you're late joining us because I believe you were at a secret wedding. You got one of the invites, did you, to Boris's wedding? and is he the UK's first Catholic Prime Minister now? Is that what that means?
Well, funnily enough, he was baptized Catholic, and then before he became Prime Minister, he converted to Protestantism. So unfortunately, he's not. So when he was gunning to be Prime Minister, there was a bit of talk about whether or not he would be the first Catholic Prime Minister in, you know, hundreds of years, and he converted to become Protestant. And so that was the whole thing. And so I spent a bit of yesterday evening, after the secret wedding was announced, speaking to some Catholic priests, and apparently he got a dispensation from the Bishop of Westminster, and had the secret wedding yesterday. So a week ago, the wedding invitations went out and said that he'd be getting married a year from, you know, yesterday. And clearly last week there was a huge amount of drama for the Conservatives when Dominic Cummings gave 7 hours of evidence in front of the Select Committee about all of the things that happened last year around the UK's preparation for coronavirus. And, you know, 2 days later, the info came out where Boris Johnson claimed not to know that £200,000 had been given for, by a Conservative donor to renovate his flat. And Boris Johnson claimed that he didn't know the £200,000 had been given. And he also claimed he didn't know that his flat had been renovated. So clearly he needs some heat taken away from both of these things. And so his wedding was brought forward by a year. And, you know, he had this secret fast wedding of only 30 people instead of 300 people in Westminster Cathedral a year hence, to try and get some very quick, very, very positive publicity in Westminster Cathedral very, very fast. So we'll see if that helps. I don't think it will. But the Conservatives feel like Teflon at the moment.
I was just going to say, does he need help? I mean, despite everything that has come out this week, he's ahead in the polls.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, there is a meme in British politics that essentially the Conservatives can, you know, Boris Johnson can announce that he's going to kill all of your children, and the Conservatives will see a 18% boost in the polls. And for the first time last night, there was one poll that said the Conservatives had seen a 6% drop. And that, as far as I can remember, is the first time that there has been a drop in the polls in months. So Labour were up by 5 points and the Conservatives were down by 6. And that's the first time I can remember there being a drop in about 6 months. But that's one poll, and that's the only poll I can remember. And it's Opinium. And Opinium are not a particularly reliable one. They're not one that most people rely on, YouGov and other polls are ones that people are a lot more reliable. So we'll see what other ones say. It's the only one that has bucked the trend in about 6 months to a year. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what comes out of this flat. The fact that Boris Johnson can claim he didn't realise the flat had been renovated is incredible. It's also incredible that Boris Johnson was in number 11, and at the time Sajid Javid was in number 10. So number 11 is a much bigger flat. At the time, Boris Johnson was in it without a child, just with his girlfriend. Sajid Javid was in the much smaller number 10 flat with four young children. And number 10 is a two-bed flat. So I have no idea how Sajid Javid was managing in a two-bed flat with four young children while Boris Johnson was in the three or four-bed number 11 flat stretched out with him and his girlfriend, who I terribly went to university with.
Don, just to Martin's point, though, and I know you're saying there's one poll, Dominic Cummings said some pretty explosive stuff this week. Whether you believe anything, well, does he? That's obviously the source is not exactly someone who has good form in this. But if you're Hancock, if you're Boris Johnson, you're in these situations, you're looking there. All their credibility is trash, and yet I don't think it seems to matter. Like, I mean, Emma, I might ask you as well, because we just before Don joined, we were talking about the Northern Ireland Protocol. There's no way that they give a damn really in Westminster about the Northern Ireland Protocol ultimately, and surely that penny has to drop. I saw a really good comment in I don't know if it was addressed to you, Emma, saying that. The penny has dropped for Brexiteers, that for Brexit, the North will have to ultimately be dumped, is how it's been put. But, that we will be looking at a border poll sooner rather than later. Well, sooner rather than later could be a time frame of anywhere up to 5 to 10 years. But nonetheless, it does seem to me that the message has gotten through in the UK, and that this nonsense over the protocol and where the border is in the sea, we're just going to have to swallow it. Is that the feeling that you have as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they just don't care. It was always going to be Brexit at any cost for English nationalists. And we've seen that even in polling within the Conservative Party, when it comes to keeping Northern Ireland versus, their ideal Brexit, Brexit comes out on top. So I think that there's a lot of rhetoric and, attempts to placate unionism from the Northern Ireland Secretary of State at the moment, but very little action. So, in reality, the penny will drop. And I think that much of what we're seeing now is because the penny is dropping. We are likely probably to see the constitutional question coming towards the polls within the next decade, which means there really needs to be very careful planning put in place, because we've seen from the report this week on the constitutional unit on referendums, it will require a lot of work both governments in order to make sure that referendum is done in an informed way.
Yeah, just to come back on that as well, and also on your point about whether or not we believe Dominic Cummings, a lot of people were asking the question, like, how much do we believe what Dominic Cummings says? What do we believe? What don't we believe out of what he said? But I think a lot of that was like quite beside the point. I believe everything that he said. What I focus on is where he wouldn't be drawn on the question. So I think that when Dominic Cummings gave evidence, I think that everything that he said was true, because what he was willing to say was what was true. So he was very, very willing to say things about Matt Hancock. He was very, very willing to come out and say things that Boris Johnson got wrong. So he was, he was more than happy to say things that Matt Hancock completely and utterly screwed up. He was more than happy to say that Matt Hancock was completely incompetent and messed up the coronavirus response very, very happily. He was very, very happy to say that Boris Johnson wanted to go on TV and get injected with coronavirus live on air. But every single time he was asked about Rishi Sunak, he immediately said, "Oh, I can't remember that. I can't recall over and over again, because he clearly thinks that Rishi Sunak is the future leader that he wants to peg all of his hopes around Brexit behind. So it's very, very obvious that with Dominic Cummings, his focus is still on Brexit, and that when it comes to Brexit, he is an English nationalist. He doesn't care about Scotland. He doesn't care about Northern Ireland. He only cares about England. He only cares about Brexit. He thinks that Michael Gove and Rishi Sunak are the future of Brexit. So whenever he was asked about Michael Gove, whenever he was asked about Rishi Sunak, his memory immediately deserted him. He couldn't remember anything about Michael Gove. He couldn't remember anything about Rishi Sunak. So Dominic Cummings just lied by omission. He couldn't remember anything about these people. He would only be positive about them. So I don't think he lied. I just immediately think that he wouldn't be drawn.
It was his narrative.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is how he's made his career, Don, in fairness.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I just very conscious of the fact that this means more, obviously, as we, you know, it's really just toxic, Emma and Don, when you see it. It's there's a lot of people. But one of the things that I want to go back to, what Colin Harvey said to us, is that we don't hear enough about, and you don't hear it actually covered well enough in the media or in any other aspect, is going that if the north of Ireland chose to, they could be back in the EU in about 30 days. I mean, never mind the Northern Ireland Protocol. Welcome back to the EU, boys and girls, and you know, and everything is, and I'm sure Scotland are watching that with just absolutely going, okay, we'd love some of that wording in our how we're going to do things down the line. But I think that momentum will start to change over the next few months. I think that narrative will start bubbling up because of people like Emma and Colin and people who are doing all those works. If we could have one other point, have Labour even landed a glove?
Yeah. I think the big problem is at the moment that when it comes to Scotland, like, Labour are essentially just falling all over the place. So when it comes to Scotland, Labour are still very much a unionist party. So Labour don't seem to understand that the SNP are very, very popular in Scotland. So, you know, Nicola Sturgeon is hugely popular, and Labour spend all of their time attacking Nicola Sturgeon. And they don't seem to understand the fact that, you know, all of my friends who are my age absolutely love Nicola Sturgeon, and Labour spend all of their time attacking her. And they don't understand why they're so unpopular with young people. And, you know, Keir Starmer is completely useless. You know, we know that. And, you know, at the same time, they can't understand why they're losing in Scotland. And they spend all of their time attacking Nicola Sturgeon and attacking the Conservatives, and then not understanding why they aren't gaining votes. So they spend all of their time attacking Scottish nationalism and then not understanding why they aren't gaining votes. But equally, the Tories aren't either. So, you know, Labour need to step back in Scotland, look at why they're losing votes, but they aren't. And they aren't, you know, doing any self-reflection at all. They're just, they are essentially just trying to rehash what they're doing in England and not understanding why they're losing votes in England and in Scotland. So Labour in Scotland are just completely losing the plot.
I have to say, when you look at it, the DUP are kind of like one of Boris's forgotten children, really and truly, you know, and you have to wonder how long it is before that
acknowledged and forgotten.
you have to wonder how long it is before that divorce happens. And I mean the DUP divorce happens. We're going to move us on a little, and we're going to talk a bit about employment. And there was employers on during the week, and they were saying they were finding it extremely difficult to get workers to come in. Now, we all know that the employers are offering top book, great conditions. So we're wondering, why do workers not want to come in? And I'm going to bring in Julia. Julia, you've been talking about this for a while, why workers aren't rushing back to get paid less than minimum wage with no tips and generally treated like shit.
Thank you, Martin. Yes, like you see, what is really shocking to me, then it comes as an attack. So, you know, the victims here, which are employees, are being accused of not wanting to go back to work. And, you know, the sector didn't even fully reopen yet. And, you know, obviously people, because this kind of job are not really... you know, they don't give you any safety even without pandemic, because people do not have full-time contracts. You know, the hours vary from week to week, as you mentioned, and it's very common in the sector. They are being deprived from the tips. They don't have the basic worker rights, like right to rest, right to break during the shift. So actually, I'm happy to announce we are launching the survey this weekend, actually from Monday, but today I would like to share the link to the survey on your podcast first.
Explain to us what the survey is, Julia. Tell us what's happening with the survey.
I'm hoping to get the data to expose then the hospitality sector, especially the employees in the hospitality sectors. They don't have the proper, the conditions of working in hospitality are absolutely disgraceful. And that is including the time before the pandemic start. So we're talking about the time when we believed that hospitality and tourism as a key component in the Irish economy will actually take us out of the crisis from 2008. And then the sector was worth 7.6 billion. And the workers still were mostly on minimum wage. And I met managers, supervisors who work below living wage. It's absolute disgrace.
And do you think it's because there's a lot of migrant workers working in the sector, Julia?
It's definitely a lot of, because it's a lot of migrant workers and a lot of very young workers. As well, the sector is dominated by females. So, you know, we get people in the positions. Then obviously, I'm not even thinking then that is like racist based if it comes to migrants. It's just then it's easier to abuse them because very often they do not know their rights and they don't speak English good enough to be able to reach out for help. That's why actually we want to specifically do translation to Portuguese because there is a lot of people from Brazil who coming here to study English. So their English, it's not really good. And they work in hospitality sector in huge numbers. And they're being horribly abused. Because, you see, they have the restriction as well. Like
On their visas restrictions on top of the employee restrictions, on top of the fact that they're, like Julia, for the benefit of listeners, is not just an organizer, but she's walked the walk taking cases against the Ivy in Dublin about the situation whereby tips were being taken as part of your salary and effectively, you know, reducing your what you're being paid. But just one thing. So the survey, we'll add the survey to the blurb, Julian. Delighted that I have the link here now. So we'll make sure that goes out as well. But in terms of the migrant community, the last time we spoke, you talked about talking to people and organizing and trying to get people to join unions in effect and become more aware of their rights. How has that gone?
Like you see, obviously, pandemic cut in the middle of it. And because there is so many people who are migrant, as Martin pointed out before, it's the best to talk to them directly. And, you know, because they less keen to engage with social media platforms, because some of those people do not have an efficient language to even read in English yet, because they just newly arrived to a new country and they don't know where to search for help. There is as well very little knowledge about trade unions in general. So it's not only about migrant workers, but in generally, people have very little knowledge and very little trust. And I actually would like to use that opportunity as well to encourage all the workers to contact me in Unite the Union, because everything they share with me is confidential. And I know that a lot of people think that, oh, I'm going to say something and it's going to go to my employer. Like it's a safety place and we can offer the advice and support you need. And we don't do anything until we get the permission of doing it by our members or whoever reach out to us.
Julie, you wanted to speak directly to the Polish community through the podcast.
If I can, I will say a few words in Polish as well. Thank you for giving me that opportunity. Dzień dobry, nazywam się Julia Marciniak, jestem koordynatorem gastronomii i turyzmu w związkach zawodowych Unite the Union. Obecnie będziemy udostępniać ankietę, która ma na celu zebranie danych na temat warunków pracy w sektorze gastronomii i turyzmu. Ankieta jest całkowicie anonimowa. Można także skontaktować się ze mną pod adresem mailowym julian.marciniak@unitedunion.org bądź pod numerem telefonu, który można znaleźć na stronach UNITA, na Facebooku UNITE Hospitality ROI i UNITE the Union Republic of Ireland. Więc bardzo proszę o kontakt. Wszystkie dane zebrane są w 100% anonimowe, a chciałabym mieć możliwość naświetlenia problemów sektora gastronomii i turyzmu. Dziękuję.
Thanks for that, Julia. Thank you.
So you not all fall asleep when I speak Polish there.
Can I just ask Dawn and Emma, with all the shenanigans, and it is shenanigans between Northern Ireland and the UK, things like workers' rights, like workers in the hospitality sector, workers in the NHS, is there any understanding of what workers have gone through? Is it anywhere on the agenda? Are we still talking Jurassic politics? Is that all that's really important?
Yeah, absolutely nothing's happening. I mean, I was speaking to my friends who work in trade union movement. I mean, I'm going into hospital next week. My mum's a nurse. My mum's caught coronavirus and my mum's got asthma. And my mum was in intensive care for 2 weeks at the height of the coronavirus crisis, and she is facing a 1% pay increase. And workers' rights is nowhere. Absolutely no employers have faced any legal action whatsoever for exposing any of their workers to coronavirus. So we're not seeing any employers facing any fallout at all for putting anybody at risk. And at the same time, we're not seeing any increase in pay or anybody who's put themselves at risk because of coronavirus have any uptick in pay. And now in the UK, the hospitality industry are reporting what we've seen in America, which is that increasingly they're struggling to recruit. And the hospitality industry are essentially saying, oh no, we may have to put our rates up. So maybe, hopefully, we may actually see some increase in pay for people who are, underpaid and overworked. But it's very, very funny that some of the worst payers in the industry are finally having to realize that they may have to increase their pay because that's how capitalism works.
Well, there's inflation in both the UK, well, in the UK and I'm going to say in the north since things have reopened. Emma, your price of pints have gone up substantially, I believe, as well. So if the price of pints have gone up, how come we're not paying wages a little bit better, no?
Yeah, I mean, as Dawn and Julia has already said, and I'd actually just say dziękuję to Julia for your contributions to this area of work. There's just nothing being done around workers' rights, and inflation is going up and people are still being paid minimum wage. And the hospitality sector, I actually have a background in hospitality. Up until 6 months ago, I was a manager of a coffee shop in Belfast and I worked in hospitality for 15 years. And the way that workers within this sector were treated during the pandemic, in terms of having to put themselves often at risk, in terms of not having the right protections in their place of work and having to go into work when maybe they didn't feel very safe to do so, really is not very well understood. And another aspect to consider in this conversation is, when we speak about hospitality, there's also all of the freelance workers in terms of musicians who would be playing the pubs and the bars. And so many of them did not have support systems or their rights protected during the pandemic and still don't. And in terms of how that industry is ever going to recover is a whole question in itself, because many of these workers are still not going to be able to get work, because even if the bars open up, it's going to be a long time before we see live music back in them.
Sorry, can I cut?
Yes.
I just jump here because I'm really, actually, when we talk about the pay raise, actually, a lot of hospitality workers experience a pay cuts now, because that's what's happened actually already after first lockdown. I know of the members who were offered less money and they accept the offers in fears then they're gonna be taken off from the pandemic unemployment payment. So we have as well a huge pressure from the restaurant association in here for making sure that employees will accept any job offered to them. Otherwise, they're going to be taken from the pandemic unemployment payment, essentially forcing people with, leaving people with no choice but accepting the atrocious conditions. And we have to as well, if it comes to safety, we have to bear in mind that those people not only facing the exploitation, the abuse, and the small wages, but as well there is safety now in the light of pandemic, it's compromised. And a lot of employees ignore the guidelines and workers didn't feel safe. I know of a few outbreaks in the restaurants in Dublin and where the workers actually were tested. They didn't get any symptoms, but they still got a COVID because there is a people in early 20s. They have strong immune system and they might still spread the virus and they can spread the virus to their loved ones at home. And as well, this age group, it's not vaccinated yet. So we're expecting them to risk their life, to risk the health of their loved ones, to get back to work for minimum wage. It's disgrace. And, you know, even the comments, because it's only the comments about pandemic unemployment payment being so high, then people don't want to come back to work. Like, wait a minute. It's 350. That's the maximum. And actually, that is adjusted to the people earnings. So that it's not only 350 for everybody. The people who made up to 200 euro before pandemic, they are paying, they are paid 303 euro now. The one over, they are paying paid 250, between 200 and 300. The one between 300, 400, they are paid 300. And only the one over 400 euro, it's 350. But, you know, like that's as well. If somebody gonna, because there were comments actually made by employers in the sector, then that 350 a week, it's like winning a lottery. Yeah. What kind of lottery you are playing? that's my question. And other thing is then we are living maybe 350 per week in Poland, in euro, brilliant money, but definitely not in Ireland, especially with the prices of rent. What kind of quality of, like, when these days you pay in Dublin for a room, like, 800 euro?
Yeah, exactly. 350 in Dublin is, like, a week is, like, not, you know, that's, this is not some sort of, you know, bonus bonanza that they can live off. And I think also worth highlighting in the north, too, that the payments that were given to staff here were essentially a 20% pay cut, you know, from day one, because the furlough scheme in the north and in the UK was 80%, and then your employers could opt to give you the other 20%, which very, very few actually did. So a lot of the people that work within the hospitality industry are on minimum wage, and many are living, you know, with just getting by with that salary. And what they really had was not 80% of their salary to stay home during the pandemic. They had a 20% pay cut for, you know, the last year, and that actually went down. The payments in the furlough scheme continued to decrease. And for many people, that would have pushed them very far below the poverty line. We heard a lot of really difficult stories of people who just could not afford their mortgage, could not afford to feed their children, could not afford to live off these reduced payments.
So Don, you were saying during the week about the fact that even waiting on invoicing, as someone who does a lot of freelance work, waiting on invoicing has been very difficult. So you're fully aware of the fact that there are people out there who aren't even paying for the work that's been done.
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to things like small claims court and that sort of thing, there is such a backlog. It's like, it's absolutely incredible. And when you go to the Citizens Advice Bureau, for instance, I've got quite a few friends who volunteer for the Citizens Advice Bureau. And a lot of my friends who are lawyers do pro bono work, and they're absolutely swamped because there are so many families who are absolutely desperate for help when it comes to speaking to their landlords. They're getting evicted illegally. And you know, there are so many people who have you know, who are desperate for visa help, especially when it comes to the EU resettlement scheme and that sort of thing. And, you know, there are so many people who are absolutely desperate for legal help, and they're, you know, desperately trying to help people who have the most extreme problems. But when it comes to somebody like me, who just has, for instance, a very big multinational who are a month behind with a payment, I can't get help because there are people with very, very extreme problems, you know, who are a very, very poor family who need help a lot more than I do. So, you know, so when it comes to coronavirus, you know, it means that people are, you know, are absolutely desperate for help, who are absolutely swamped and way behind with all of these things. So, you, you know, it means that everybody is, you know, has all of these rights, and you know, and they can't get access to all of this help because everybody is a lot further behind than everything else, you know. And it feels exactly the same when it comes to earnings and that sort of thing. So if you look at, you know, globally, you look at the fact that billionaires have made a huge amount of money when it comes to the coronavirus crisis. And then you look at everybody else and you realise that everybody else has lost a lot of money. It's, but obviously the richest, Jeff Bezos, etc., have made a lot of money.
It's the largest transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top in the last 100 years. So that's effectively in history, because that's when records really began.
And let me just, this brings us really kind of neatly on to our own Tánaiste. When he said that employers could just report workers who wouldn't go back. And that was the day before he actually celebrated a small farmer getting stamped out by Intel. Tony, you have a few thoughts on all of this.
No, I just think he's Ireland's greatest commentator now. He really is. I mean, I couldn't believe I saw a tweet from him early in the week, and you know I was very angry, and no one picked up on it because he was in effect interfering with the independence of the central bank by encouraging a review into the mortgage lending rules, which the new governor of the central bank, Gabriel McAlouf, came in. The ECB, it's documented, weren't happy for him to take the job. There was a cloud of controversy following him from New Zealand. He wasn't an economist, and they thought there was rumors of leaks from his office. This is all well documented. I'm not saying anything that's going to get us done for defamation here. And the ECB weren't keen on, but Fine Gael wanted him in. And now Fine Gael want him to move on mortgage the criteria. And people are going to welcome this, which just means that there'll be more credit chasing fewer homes and driving up more prices. The answer is not more money. The answer is affordable homes. I didn't like that he did that publicly. He did it on social media. Then he went on. We spoke to the guys who made the document, well, the docudrama, Thomas Reed, in 2018, about the farmer who lost the case initially to Intel because they had bully boy tactics, effectively, to take his land. He won on appeal, Martin, as you recall, because Intel had acted inappropriately and gone beyond their remit. But now, then the Tánaiste, they've won this case now, and the Tánaiste tweeted, "Great news." Again, Ireland's he's commentating on this. And again, I remind people, 25th of April, he was on a call hosted by good buddies, stockbrokers with vulture funds and REITs that I'm well aware of. And he told them, when he said, "What message have you got for us?" He said, "Stick with us. And we'll get through this, and we'll be back to kind of business as usual as quickly as we can."
And in that too, Tony, we're seeing a worsening housing crisis that's just getting worse and worse. And we're at the stage where I think everybody now realizes there is absolutely no will on Fine Gael's part to change the course on.
They don't want to, because they know that's not their electorate. Their electorate don't worry about that. They're making money from this process. I mean, that's where their vote base is. Their ABC ones vote Fine Gael, but unfortunately for Fianna Fáil, they've hitched their wagon to them, and they can't undo it. And now they know that they're actually going to be the people who'll get screwed. I think Mick Clifford actually had a piece where he said, "I think Fine Gael have decided, look, this is all good for us. We'll stick with our hardcore, and this is what we'll do." Fianna Fáil are the people who need to wake up. I agree with that. I just want to mention on the housing piece, though, go again, Killian Woods, this time with Peter O'Dwyer, piece about those funds making $3 billion in profits in the first 3 years, when we're told that there's no money to be made, that the builders can't make any money in developing houses, and yet they're making out like bandits, low taxed, given tax breaks. Very important to also point out on those tax breaks, they are already applying to the Irish state to get the contracts to do the use the REIT model on renewable energy. So your wind farms, your offshore, all of that, they've been on, they're on the lobbying register. They want to do that, and they want to use that capital that these huge investment funds have to sell us back renewable energy that they will then own. Yeah. And that is a big risk. That is coming down the pipeline as well. Can we just really quickly mention the outdoor summer, guys? John, you guys are all vaccinated. Emma, you're all vaccinated. Everybody back out having pints and all. I don't know if you saw last night, everybody lost their minds in Dublin City Centre. Any thoughts?
Yeah, your chief doctor went ballistic, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's his job, isn't it? Really, like that's his job. But I mean,
scenes were wild. Like you saw how many people were out in the streets. It was mad. Like how could he not react like that?
Yeah, but I think also you have to manage expectations, and it comes back to what Tony was saying about kite flying. A lot of kite flying from the government about we're opening up. When you constantly drum that message into people, they feel more secure to come out. I mean, to be honest about it, there is not going to be a line in the sand where one day we're all opened up. This is a very gradual process. It could take years to get completed, but the government doesn't want to come out and say that.
And yeah, so I think a lot of
the circumstances.
A huge amount of it is back covering. I think we see a lot of it in Britain as well. So obviously, when it comes to press conferences in the UK, there's always a lot of back covering. And obviously, in the UK, we're far ahead in terms of vaccination. So you know, I feel like more than half of us now are double vaccinated, so we're a lot safer. But at the same time, the UK government are still warning people to be very, very careful, because even after being double vaccinated, there's still a bit of nervousness that you may be able to pass the vaccine on. So there's still a lot of back covering. So I can see why the government are doing that, but it still feels a little bit mean how much Ireland have given up.
If I can address one thing in Dublin, it's the simple fact that they closed a lot of areas to people where they would normally go, plazas and areas where people would sit out. And then they said, and then everybody congregated in the one area where they could. It's bad planning as much as everything else. You can't do that. And we have to be cognizant of that. And then I also going to completely contradict myself and say with my head thumping that a week ago there was talk of giving Dublin City Council, well, county councils across the country are really, really shittily paid, Martin, as we know. And there was talk of giving them kind of a living wage and effect a better pay rise. And everybody who was objecting to what happened yesterday and objecting to the rubbish that's on the street are also objecting to them getting a pay rise.
There are no bins. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, my friend is getting married in Dublin next week, and he's flying over from London to Dublin with his, you know, to see his wife's family. And the number of times that they've had to change the wedding, cancel the wedding, move the wedding. And even now they're still having to change plans, and the amount of stress they've had at the wedding, the amount of times they've had to change the plans is unreal. And they're still even now having to change plans because the rules around the wedding change so often. I feel so sorry for them. And just overnight seeing, you know, the government have a go at people who've just been out for a rake of cans, and it's like, just chill out, for God's sake. Do you realize how much people have gone through? Just let people have a Saturday night out and just stop shouting at them.
Yeah, we're going to move on to a Q&A in a couple of minutes, and the recording on the official podcast will stop. But before we do, we can't let it go without saying, hey, how you doing? Yeah. and we have to say
do we all know that Matt LeBlanc actually is dating someone from County Fermanagh?
I heard this.
She's a producer on Top Gear.
That's right.
Well, I tell you, he was everybody's favorite Irish uncle for the last 24 hours, and I hope he gets
until Simon Harris ruined it.
Yeah. I tell you, that guy could kill an erection in a brothel. He's unreal.
Can't believe he amazes me. He looks 20 years older.
But it was nice to see everybody having a bit of fun, and the amount of the incredible the memes themselves. But everybody going, come here to me, you know. And what is it you're studying now? And all of the lines were just brilliant. But I'm going to obviously plug my own one where he looked at me and he said, so Martin tells you he he'd help you with the production of the podcast, did he?
But there are some, I thought there were some really clever ones, and it was really nice to see that he was cast as this kind of, maybe not understanding everything kind of uncle, but very accepting of it all. Sure, yeah. You go and do whatever you're going to do. Sure, doesn't bother me in the least bit, you know. And I thought that was a really nice aspect, because that kind of sums up, I mean, where we see that kind of Cavan brother-in-law, Longford fella, that's where we see them. And I think that's where they're at, is it mightn't understand everything, but you're doing nobody any harm. And I thought that was lovely.
Before we wrap, sorry, on this, I just want to say, I see Brian is in the audience. Brian, I got your question. I've spoken to Deirdre Neeline, the construction solicitor. We are going to talk about that anyway this week, coming as soon as Deirdre finds a spot. So we'll have, not just, won't be answering on the podcast, we'll be answering with an actual expert who knows what she's talking about. So I did see your question. I think we'll leave it there, Martin, for this week in terms of the actual pod. If you want to join, if you want to come along, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and we do really appreciate it.